Well, we're going to discuss tonight three ways of proposing. Did you hear about the couple that were going together for about 33 years? And the girl was getting a bit impatient, and she said to him, "Don't you think we ought to think about getting married?" And he said, "At our age, who'd be having either of us?" And now some true stories about proposal, brief ones. This little girl, when she was a young woman, when she was proposed to, was asked by the young man, "What kind of an engagement ring would you like?" And she whipped out of her purse a picture of a ring that she had cut out of a paper 10 years before. There's nothing like being prepared. And then this other young lady had been waiting for a year or two for a proposal, and she was absolutely sure that on Christmas Eve he would bring a ring and propose. So she was watching him very carefully as he came in, and he had a great big box, a fine box of chocolates, which he gave her. Well, she was so mad. When she saw those chocolates, she chucked them all into the fire, ring and all. They're not married to this day. There are various ways of making a proposal, and the way one proposes depends upon how one loves, and there are three ways of loving: the Christian way, the romantic way, and the scientific way. The Christian way is based upon the fact that the other person is a gift of God and is a person. A person is composed of body and soul. The body is the source of allurement, the soul is the source of content and consent, and both of them go to make up that which is most precious in this world, namely personality. And in the face of a blessing, such as the other person, one feels a sense of unworthiness. And that is one of the reasons why, in proposing, one regards the other person as a gift, and the other person regards the one proposing as a gift, and both think of themselves as gifts of God that are under some expression of the will of God in a relationship one to the other. And because of that humility, that is why a proposal of that kind is often made on the knees. Because the beloved is always on the pedestal, the lover is always on his knees. He does not deserve that blessing. Every communion has that sense of unworthiness, even though it be the soul with the divine master, or person with person. The cry is, "Oh Lord, I am not worthy." And in the engagement, man is willing to surrender his freedom out of love. Of course, the girl may say when he proposes, "Now, listen, you say you love me. You say that you love me above every other girl in the world. Do you realize that there are 683,412 eligible young women in this city? Have you tried all of them before you came to me? How do I know that you love me more than you love them?" Well, if he's a good metaphysician, which he probably isn't, but if he is, he will say, "Listen, every act of love is not only an affirmation. Every act of love is also a negation. And the mere fact that I choose you, I reject everyone else in all the world." And that is true of real love. Now, of course, when a man makes the proposal and becomes engaged, he goes through all sorts of fantastic actions. Some have been very well described by Chesterton. When G.K. Chesterton became engaged to Francis Blogg on a bridge in St. James's Park, London. He felt it was necessary, after she had accepted him, to go home and tell Francis Blogg's mother that he had proposed. And Gilbert Chesterton was very nervous. Didn't know exactly how to tell the mother, and the mother perceived that Gilbert was very nervous. She had just finished papering the house. And so she thought, well, maybe she could calm Chesterton a bit by saying, Gilbert, what do you think of the wallpaper? So Chesterton was at art school. He had a great big black crayon in his pocket, and he immediately stood up like a great knight, went to the wallpaper, and drew on the side of the wall a great portrait of Francis, his beloved. And when he proposed to her, he wrote something like this. It was a beautiful expression of a Christian engagement. There are four lamps of thanksgiving always before me. The first is for my creation out of the same earth with such a woman as you. The second is that I have not, with all my faults, gone after strange women. You cannot think how a man's self-restraint is rewarded in this. The third is that I have tried to love everything alive, a dim preparation for loving you. And the fourth is, but no words can express that. Here ends my previous existence. Take it. It led me to you. Young men who are like to have copies of Chesterton's proposal may write to me. Then there's another kind of love, which is the romantic love, in which love is divorced from the divine will and from a religious basis. One is not so much interested in the other person. Therefore, one does not have that sense of unworthiness in the face of a gift of God. Rather, one is interested in the other person because of the pleasure the other person gives me. That's romantic love. In other words, the ego, or the self, is projected into someone else. And then it is made to appear that the other person is loved. And all that is loved is the ego in the other person. Hence the German poet Goethe, when he was 74 years of age, proposed to a girl 17 in such romantic, gushy, sentimental language that it was, when it was all over, she didn't know it was her proposal. And Goethe's Faust was not interested in creating love in someone else, expressing reverence. He was only interested in seeing love created in himself. Don Juan the same. Don Juan needed another person in order to beget this experience within himself. But he was without any reverence for a person outside. Stendhal wrote on love at the beginning of the last century. Gave an expression of romantic love that ought to make young women beware. He said that love is like crystallization. He said that in the salt mines of Salzburg, a strange phenomenon takes place. If one cuts the leaves off a limb of a tree and puts the limb down into the salt mine of Salzburg, after several weeks, that limb will come out as if it were glittering with diamonds. Stendhal said, that is what you have to do in love. You have to crystallize the other person. Endow the person with qualities in your proposal which the other person really does not have. Well, that kind of romantic love very often ends in something actually that is very unromantic. And perhaps one of the best expressions of that kind of proposal, of romantic love, where it is always, remember, the self that is the principal interest, was well expressed in Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. That great classic of English literature, you remember, contains the proposal of a clergyman by the name of Mr. Collins to Elizabeth Bennet. Mr. Collins is not on his knees, but he proposes in the romantic fashion. Notice the importance of the eye, not the importance of the lady. My reasons for marrying you are. Incidentally, it's the man who always gives the reasons. I love you because you're beautiful, or because you're this, or because you're that. A woman never gives a reason. She loves. That's the reason. So Mr. Collins gives reasons. My reasons for marrying you are, first, that I think it is the right thing to do for every clergyman in easy circumstances, like myself, to set an example of matrimony in the parish. And secondly, that I am convinced it will add very greatly to my happiness. And thirdly, which perhaps I ought to have mentioned earlier, that it is the particular advice and recommendation of a very noble lady whom I have the honor of calling patroness. It was but last Saturday night that she said, "Mr. Collins, you must marry. A clergyman like you must marry. Choose properly, choose a gentlewoman for my sake and for your own." It remains to be told why my views were directed to you instead of to my own neighborhood, where I assure you there are many available young women. And now nothing remains for me but to assure you in the most animated language of the violence of my affection. I'm sure nobody will want this proposal. Well, Elizabeth Bennet, of course, refused Mr. Collins, and he said that you must give me leave to flatter myself that your refusal of my addresses are mere words. I shall therefore interpret your refusal to your wish of increasing my love by suspense, according to the usual practice of elegant females. In the romantic too, one might associate the utilitarian, and we'll pass that over very quickly. That's marrying someone for money. And for great money sometimes was asked if you married the most beautiful daughter in the family, and then you were paid a great deal of money if you married the ugliest. Sir Thomas More, the English Chancellor and martyr and saint, married the ugliest daughter in a family just to please the family. He happened to be an excellent gentleman. It turned out all right, though she tried to convince him that he should not go to the stake and be martyred for his faith. And then, of course, there is the American businessman that I heard of. When the young man proposed to his daughter, he said, "Leave your name, address, telephone number. If nothing better turns up, I'll phone you." Well, the young man finally married her, and as they came out of the church, the father said to the groom, "I want you to know, young man, that you're the second happiest man in the world." Well, that utilitarian love we can ignore, because there's only one kind of love that can be bought. That's a puppy's. Now, in addition to the Christian, and in addition to the romantic and the purely utilitarian, there is the scientific, which is the very modern way of making love. And you'd be surprised how very common this is. As is inspiration in Freud, and Sartre, and Marx. Take, for example, love under Marx and communism. The only important thing in all the world, according to Marx, is economic production. And marriage was to sustain private property. It was built upon it, rather. Private property goes, marriage is no longer needed. When communism began in Russia, though they found out socially and experimentally that this plan did not work, but when it began, the communist theory was drink the water, forget the glass. In other words, the person does not matter. The person now completely dissolves and fades away. The Christian person now is not always even the pleasure. And communism has insisted that party leaders in various countries should take the wives that Moscow dictates. And you'd be surprised how often that happens. And then there's also the Freudian, where love is reduced to sex. See, what Freud has done is to interpret the person in terms of sex instead of understanding sex in terms of the person. Well, obviously, all human relations are going to be upset on that principle. So that a proposal, Freudian character, might run something like this. Darling, I've been to see my psychiatrist. And I am sure that you have been to see yours. He assures us that we are erotically adjusted. If, therefore, it will be possible for you to give a free expression to your id, so that all of your great primitive libidinous instincts are able to manifest themselves without being submerged or smothered by that terrible superego of religion, morality, myths, and taboos that society, convention, and divinity has given us, well, then I think that possibly we might be able to make a go of this thing for a couple of years. And then those, of course, who do not know Freud and all of the intricacies, but nevertheless live in a purely scientific atmosphere where love is analyzed scientifically and the person disappears. For those, the engagement takes place something like this. The man pulls a ring out of it. Pocket, maybe. He's in overalls, she's in slacks. How about it, babe? I really and truly know of one young man who was going with this girl. She was not expecting the engagement ring. They had stopped at a restaurant. And he went in to get some food and drink for her. And she was drinking a glass of water, and she almost swallowed the ring. He had put it in the glass of water. Not put on her finger, just in the cup. Person is no longer important. Then, of course, we have in the modern age engagement by UNIVAC. Now we've reached the peak of scientific love. Because you put into this great machine your cards, and I put into it my cards, and we finally reach some kind of solution of adjustment as regards marriage. The old ancients, they used to sometimes read the entrails of birds to find out what the future was. Today we read the entrails of machines to discover what we ought to do. And so, in such a machine, engagement and proposal of that kind, one might say, well now, my dear, I love rock and rye, you love rock and roll. I love onions, you love Clorets. You love the Ten Commandments, I like shorts. You like to spend money? I like to make it. You like to smoke cigarettes? I smoke filters. And you were also the kind, I am sure, that you remember how we met. It was in the most unusual way. We were introduced. So I'm your wolf. Will you be my hound dog? And perhaps we can make out a mathematical correlation of a life expectancy of 38 years with an assured annuity of $4,200 a year. And now what's happening? To the beautiful God-given thing called love. This is what's happening. It used to be that individuals sacrificed themselves for institutions. Today, institutions are sacrificed for the whims of individuals. The three great institutions of the universe are the church, the nation, and the family. And a man would sacrifice his own individual life and security and safety in order to defend his faith. Out of that came martyrdom. The second great institution, the nation. Man bore a deep loyalty to his nation. He was willing, if need be, in time of war, to sacrifice his life for the cause of his fatherland. And out of that devotion came our heroes. And then there was another great institution, namely the family. And when there were trials, and when there were crosses, and when there were misunderstandings, man and woman realized that they were two in one flesh, that they symbolized the union of Christ and the church, that they were the carnal symbol in some way of the divine and of a great and mysterious sacrament. And so they would put up with these crosses and trials simply because they bore loyalty to the institution of the family. But now, the world is full of those that will sacrifice the great institutions of the universe, the institutions that hold us together, just for the sake of satisfying an individual fancy. First of all, the church. There'll be some that would not like their pastor, so they give it up. It's like jumping over a ship simply because you do not like the captain. And as regards the nation, it used to be that we had only one known traitor in our history. Now there are tens of thousands of them. We're willing to sacrifice their fatherland out of a passive devotion, sometimes an active one, for a Marxist philosophy of hate. And then as regards the family, it is only the ego and one's own pleasure and one's own contentment that matters. And in the midst of trials, there's no sense of devotion and loyalty. Why was it that in former days, men stood trials for the sake of these great institutions? Simply because all three of them were rooted in God. And because they were rooted in God, therefore one drew strength from the source of these institutions. And if we are ever to become strong again as a nation, young couples have to realize that the love that they have is something that is given to them from above. That every man promises a woman something that woman can never give. that a woman promises a man something that man can never give, namely perfect happiness. Only God can give that. They are merely the John the Baptist announcing the great Messiahs of love. All that they have in this earth is just simply a spark, and they have to realize that it all has come from heaven. To say that if the spark is so bright, what must be the flame? To say one to another, if your heart can cast me into such an ecstasy of love, then what must be the great heart of God? By now, and God love you.